Viktor Frankl said, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson. Stay tuned for the next hour as Sue explores the human psyche, what makes us tick, and how to live better, more fulfilled, and more meaningful lives. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM. My guest today is Rabbi Levi Avtson, and I'm so happy to have him with me. I was told this weekend that my best programs are when I'm with Rabbi Levi Avtson. Our topic today is In Their Name, and we would like to dedicate this program to Rabbi Avtson's uncle. Rabbi, hello, and would you like to mention your uncle's name?
Thank you so much, Sue. It's a privilege and an honor to be here once again. My uncle, his name was Chaim Meir, Rabbi Chaim Meir ben Aaron Mendel Chazan. He lived in Israel and passed away last week at the age of 78, and he was a very special individual, and thank you for graciously offering to honor him.
And that was your mom's brother, that's right. Is that right?
Correct, my mom's brother, older brother.
Now, Rabbi, we are going to be talking today. What sparked this interest, actually, to talk about a name is that you sent a letter on our Lingsfield Shul group, a letter that you said your late maternal grandfather, Aaron Chazan, had handwritten, and it was dated the 11th of January, 1949. Please, will you tell me and our listeners about your uncle and what he said in this letter?
So the truth is, there's a lot of context that has to be given. I often find that when we talk to people about those years, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, most people will focus on the challenges of Nazism, etc. But there's a whole other story that, unfortunately, I don't feel is often known. So let me just set the scene. My grandparents were born in the early 1900s in Ukraine. Basically, my whole family comes from Ukraine. One grandmother comes from Russia. And Ukraine before the war was no paradise. It was hell on earth. And that was because of many pogroms, but also after communism took over Russia and then eventually Ukraine and all the surrounding areas, they went on an absolute rampage, both spiritually and physically. So spiritually, they basically arrested, killed, sent to exile anybody who held on to religious beliefs or whoever didn't smile at Stalin's face or whatever, not, you know, crazy thing happened. And then there was also this forced, Stalin wanted to force everybody to hand over all their possessions and basically to take everything into the government's hands. And he created a man-made starvation where basically they took away all the produce and everything, and close to 5 million people died in the Ukraine in the early 1930s just by man-made famine. I mean, Ukraine has some of the most wheat in the world. It's the biggest wheat, one of the biggest wheat producers in the world, but Stalin just because decided to starve 5 million people to death. So the point is that my grandparents grew up in this and suffered tremendously. Also the fact that they were religious Jews and they were being persecuted endlessly. My grandfather wrote a book about it years later called Deep in the Russian Night. Now, eventually they got married. They met each other. They got married in the late 30s. And very soon after that, if Stalin wasn't being difficult enough, he decided in the 37, 38, to go on a full-on militancy against everybody who he suspected wasn't loyal to the state. And he went absolutely ballistic. And in that purge, he killed many of the original communists, all the people who he felt were loyal to his opposition, which was a Jewish fellow named Trotsky. And he eventually got Trotsky killed in Mexico. Trotsky had ran away to Mexico. But in that rampage, many of my relatives were killed, including two great uncles. So my grandmother's two brothers, who were fathers and married, honorable, decent people of the community, because they were religious and teaching their kids Torah, they were schlepped out of the house and shot very soon after. So this is even before the Holocaust began. Then the Holocaust starts, and Hitler, after breaking his pact with Russia, you know, originally, you know, Germany and Russia decided to split Poland half and half, but then Hitler decided to go into Russia, and that part of the Holocaust, which is also very unknown, is the Jews that were living in Lithuania, Ukraine, Russia, they weren't sent to gas chambers. They were, that was called the Holocaust of bullets. They were just taken out of their cities. Many people in this community in Johannesburg, in South Africa, would know about this because they're relatives as well. In Lithuania, most of these people were not sent to gas chambers and not to catacombs. They were just taken out of their cities in horse and buggy and whatever, you know, forms of communication, dug their own pits and shot. And that basically happened to my grandfather's entire family. He was, his father and mother were the rabbinic couple in a small town in Ukraine called Krasnostav, which ironically, Krasnostav in Russian means Red Lake. And it got that name according to tradition because years earlier, the Cossacks had murdered so many people that the lake nearby turned red. So, and then basically the entire city, which was 950 Jews, were all taken out of the city. My grandfather was the rabbi just before he was shot. He gave a rousing speech. We know that because two girls managed to run out and save themselves and eventually report back to my grandfather what happened at this moment. So basically my great-grandfather gave a rousing speech about that, you know, be proud to die as Jews. And he was the first to be hit by bullets. And they then shot many. Unfortunately, to make the matters even worse, they didn't kill everybody, but they buried them anyway. And the non-Jews who were living in the area said that they were able to see breath coming out of the earth for the next 3 days. No, it's like absolute hell on earth. You cannot believe these things actually happen. And in there were killed my great-grandfather, great-grandmother, two of their children, basically the other two children besides my grandfather, were killed, and their children. So these are my mother's first cousins, young kids, four young boys, all under the age of five, all murdered. And basically my grandfather, who had suffered 20 years of starvation and persecution for being a Jew, now discovers he doesn't have a single living relative after World War II.
And how did he discover that?
He discovered it because, first of all, he writes in his book that sometime in the mid-40s, he has a dream. And in his dream, his mother and father come to him and tell him that they suffered so much and they were tortured and they died sometime in September 1941. And he kind of freaked out. And he ran to his a mentor and he said, what should I do? Should I say Kaddish for them? And his mentor said, just wait, you'll find out more information. And those two girls who survived eventually found where my grandfather was living and sent him a letter and communicated exactly what happened. It was early September 1941 when the whole city was murdered. But could you imagine his anguish? Now, just to make matters worse, his anguish, this was it wasn't as if his life till then was great. As I mentioned, he suffered incredible famine and persecution. His wife had lost two brothers by the communists, and then her last surviving brother was drafted into the Russian army to fight the Nazis and never heard of again. And for the rest of their life, they never had evidence that he was murdered. So the poor wife, my grandmother's sister-in-law, was never halachically allowed to marry. She was called an aguna, and she basically had to raise her three kids. So basically, my grandmother lost all her three brothers, and the two brothers who were killed by the communists, all their kids were killed by the Nazis a year after their father was murdered. In Odessa, and only one child survived, and he ended up building a whole family. In other words, one of the grandchildren. So literally, this poor family is broken, and then they can't even get out of Russia. So my grandfather and grandmother got stuck in Russia after the war for another 20 years. They only were released in 1966. So from their birth in the 1910s till they arrived in Israel in 1966, these two never had a day of sanity. It was 45 to 50 years of anguish. They had, and the story just keeps on building because they ended up having 13 children in while living in Russia. But and that's a story we'll tell after the break.
Yes, please. So please, you know when the breaks are.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And my guest today is Levi Upson, Rabbi Levi Upson. By the way, I didn't say it before, but he is my rabbi. Rabbi was telling us a story about his maternal great-grandfather and his horrific life and his grandmother's, their horrific life and all that they had lost. And a letter was sent. And in that letter, he spoke about his mother, father, sister, brother, sister-in-law, and four young nephews who were shot and buried in a mass grave outside his hometown of Krasnostav in Ukraine. And some were even buried while still alive. And the rabbi was saying that they know that because people had seen steam coming out of the ground for a few days afterwards. And two young girls managed to run away and eventually contacted his maternal grandfather, and told him what his the courage that his great grandfather had had as a rabbi to the group. Rabbi, I've summarized that very quickly, but I wanted you to go on, please.
So the story gets even crazier because my grandparents lost a child during the war. So my mother's oldest brother, he was a young boy named Zusha, who was born, I believe, in 1939 and 1940. And my grandfather was drafted into the Russian army together with his brother-in-law. I mentioned before the break, his brother-in-law was drafted into the army and never came home. My grandfather was actually managed to be saved miraculously. And I want to tell that story because it's a fascinating story. I shared it with my family this year at the Pesach Seder because our family tradition is that when we sit at the Seder and we do the karpas, which is the third step in the Seder, so some people dip in parsley or potato. Our family tradition is onion. And as I was about to dip the onion, I sat with my kids and I was like, by the way, I don't know if you know this, I am alive today and you're all alive today because of an onion. So why? Because my grandfather, after being drafted into the Russian army, knew that he has to get out because basically it was a death sentence. 5 million Russian soldiers died during the war. It was madness. So he has to prove that he's an unhealthy man and therefore cannot fight. So there's many parts to the story, but at some stage in the story, he needs to get proof that he's a sick man. So he eats a raw onion and smokes heavy cigarettes. Now, if you eat a raw onion and smoke a pack of cigarettes right after, your heart will be beating at some crazy rate. And then walks in and turns to this person and says, please check my heart. I'm not feeling well. I have a heart thing. And they look at the heart and they see this guy's really halfway through a heart attack. And they signed that he has a heart condition. And that was just one part of the story about how he eventually was released of the Russian army, only to discover his wife had run away because where she was living in Odessa, the Nazis had taken over. She had run to the other side of the Soviet Union, Uzbekistan. He arrives in Uzbekistan many months after, only to discover that his only son had succumbed to typhus and starvation. And
at
died.
Age
2.
Oh.
Until today, we have no idea where he's buried. He's buried in the town of Zhizhak, Uzbekistan. But I don't know if there was ever a stone. I don't know which cemetery. I wouldn't even know where to begin searching. And he lost his only son and discovers he didn't even know when he left home that his wife was pregnant. So he discovers he has a new daughter, but no son. So he had two daughters at that stage, no son. Lost his entire family, as I mentioned earlier, father, mother, sister, brother, and all their children. What does that do to a man? What does that do to a man? Then they get stuck behind the Soviet Union for 20 more years and end up having 13 kids besides the boy that was killed.
Gosh.
My mother is the 12th.
Oh, wow. And did they all live?
They all lived. They all lived. And then, you know, when often people, as a, just an aside note, people often say, why do you believe in long in big families? And I say, if I didn't believe in long, big families, if my parents didn't believe in big families, I wouldn't be alive today. My Absolutely. Mother was number 13 out of 14, including the one that passed away. And they had all these children after losing their son. Mm-hmm. They had 11 more kids after that. So like these are people that were made out of something that I try to dig deep within myself and access even 1%, because you suffered your entire childhood with starvation. You then lose your whole family by the Nazis. Then you suffer 20 more years of persecution by the communists because they were being persecuted because my grandfather would never work on the Shabbos. So every year or every 6 months, he had to find a new job because he was always just gaming the system not to work on Shabbos. Anyways, the letter you referenced, he wrote in 1949, 17 years before he even left Russia. He managed to get a letter out and send it to a friend who lived in Israel. And in this letter, he describes his incredible anguish of discovering that he doesn't have a single living relative, losing his son, and just like, and not having food, and fighting just to keep Shabbos, and fighting just to raise his family. I don't know, when that letter, someone shared it on the family group last week, and it was just the day before Holocaust Memorial Day, and I was like, these are the stories we don't know. When we hear Holocaust stories, obviously there are certain, the old stories have to be told. It's Auschwitz, Treblinka, it's Anne Frank, and so many of these stories, but there's so many other stories. There's 6 million stories, and this is just one family. And if my grandfather hadn't survived, that would be an entire family no one would ever hear of. Because these were not even documented murders. Though in Ukraine, it's not as if they took people's names. This is not like the concentration camps where names were. And this was just find every Jew, take them outside the city, shoot them, bury them, and move on to the next city. Unbelievable madness.
And deprivation. I mean, you know, with the starvation, and to still bring up so many children, you had to feed them, and also knowing that they could also be taken away and killed. I mean, you know, they had faced such horrors themselves to still believe in a future for their children. I found that in itself miraculous, quite honestly. The will to live and to find meaning in bringing up your family, a new family, is just remarkable.
And not just that, but to give them such an identity, because I was mentioning my uncle, passed away last week. My uncle, I wrote an article about him in the Shul newsletter this week. He was if you met him, he was a very simple man at first glance. Not the party, life of the party, not loud, shy, bashful, you know, very low-key kind of character. And yet, this is a fellow who learned 150 pages of Talmud before his bar
meet. Oh, wow.
He would take, because he wanted to keep Shabbos, he couldn't go to the school next to his home because he would have to go to school on Shabbos. So they found a trade school on the other side of Moscow with like 2-3 hours of transport every single day. Just that, because they didn't teach on Saturday. But he still wanted to learn Torah. So he would wake up every morning, 3 or 3:30 in the morning, sit with my grandfather and study for an hour, then take 2-3 hours of buses, arrive to a full day of school, come back just because he didn't want to go to school on Shabbos.
Wow. And the fear also of coming back. He must have been coming back in the dark.
In an anti-Semitic country, in a place where literally he came home. What do you think he ate when he got home? A piece of bread. There was nothing. Absolute deprivation. This was communist Russia of the 50s and 60s. This was absolute nothing. And when my grandparents left Russia and arrived in Israel, by the way, a few months before the Six-Day War, they arrived in September 1966. And the Six-Day War was May 1967. June. They show up, and like people are like, what? This family walked out of Soviet Russia, 50 years of persecution, all proud Jews, etc. And that's why I take such pride in the story. Not because I feel like in any way I'm special, that I come from the family. It's such a sense of obligation that if you come from people that have committed so much, then you have to dig in within yourself and find that strength to fight the challenges of our day. They had their sets of challenges, which are unimaginable, but I have my set of challenges and I have to find that strength.
And you know, you say that you told your children at the Seder, at the Passover meal, about the onion. What was their reaction? Because what you're doing there is you're teaching your own children about responsibility and remembrance. What was their reaction to your story?
It was amusement, and also it's such a journey, I find. I'm very passionate, as you can tell, about genealogy, history. I always say this, the most important subject as a rabbi, I believe this, but as a Jew, I believe this is obviously Judaism and our heritage. But the second most important subject in my mind, and the most important, let's say, called secular subject, is history. History is so much more important than language and maths. And not that language and maths aren't important, but history is everything. So trying to communicate with my children history, it's like this huge gap. Often I talk to older people and they're like, no one wants to hear my stories. And I'm like, I agree, but then it's our obligation to figure out a way. And that's why the onion was such a great way to do it, because it was an imagery. It's not like, let me just tell you about your grandfather who you never met, who lived in Russia that you can't even imagine. And it's like, no, here's an onion. And let me tell you how this onion played a huge part in the fact that you're alive today. And I think that's so much of what we do on Passover and throughout the Jewish tradition is symbolism. In other words, our ancestors were slaves in Egypt, and now we're going to eat matzah, you know, hard cardboard, because 3,300 years ago, they ate this bread. So we're not just going to tell you the story, we're going to taste the story, and we're going to taste the bitter herbs, and we're going to spill the blood to signify the loss of life and the plagues, etc. But everything is going to have the wine and the blood. Sorry, everything is all about translating history in a very visual experience.
Absolutely. And you know, I also love the story of it was Nachshon who walked in into the sea. And you know, and I mentioned it a while ago on one of my programs that we're all being tasked with being a Nachshon of our age. Each of us, we are being asked, especially as anti-Semitism rises again, we're each asked to be that person who's going to walk forward and share our stories and remember the name.
And also to realize that, I saw this fascinating insight yesterday, someone says, we are tomorrow's history. In other words,
absolutely.
At some stage, we all live through history because there's always a generation that follows us that tries to unpack our lives. And what are they going to unpack? You know, I always joke that if I want to read my grandfather's life, I read his letters. And maybe there's few and far between. But if my grandchildren are going to read my life, they're going to have to follow my reactions on WhatsApp. Did grandpa give a heart or did he give a thumbs up? Because we're not communicating anymore. We're not sharing the story. If somebody actually wanted to make sense of our lives, how would they? You know, by three-letter words on Twitter, by when that ability to truly share the story. You know, tonight is Yom HaZikaron, the Memorial Day in Israel, and focusing on the soldiers lost and all those who are lost to terror. Stories have to be told, but before they have to be told, they have to be understood by ourselves. We have to make sense of our story. We have to build a narrative of our lives. A narrative of hope. You could also choose a narrative of despair. When I tell my grandparents' story, some of the listeners, I'm sure, heard the narrative of despair. But if you met my grandparents, there wasn't a cynical, sad bone in their body. Even though they went through so much, they went and built. And therefore today, my grandparents have close to 1,500 living descendants, blood relatives. It's not just the size of their families. It's the fact that 1,500 descendants believe in what they believed.
It's amazing. Wow. And, you know, just knowing your mom and seeing how positive she is and enthusiastic about her grandchildren. And then, you know, you don't get that from a place of fear. So she was certainly not brought up in a home fear-filled.
It was even though it was a home so deprived. She writes a story. My mother left Russia at the age of 6, and she had never seen a citrus in her life. So they take a 3-day train ride out of Russia because they were desperate to get out. They finally got permission to get out, and they end up in Austria. And at some stage in Austria, they're waiting to get their visas into Israel, etc. And someone gives them a citrus, an orange, a nachi. And they have no idea what this is. Like, they start playing with it. Like, what is it? Until they discover, like, oh, this is actually, you peel it off.
Beautiful. And
you. So they have no idea. Like, it's crazy.
It is crazy. But, you know, Elie Wiesel said, just as man cannot live without dreams, he cannot live without hope. If dreams reflect the past, hope summons the future. And to me, as you're telling the story, I'm seeing that your grandparents held on to hope, which did summon the future. And you named your youngest daughter Batya. And this was after your grandfather's mother.
Correct. I would say it's so much more than hope. It's a deep sense of faith that this world is not a jungle. In other words, hope means I believe in something's going to happen. Faith is basically, even though my life is so hard, I believe that I have a loving Father in heaven who's directing us. And this is intentional. And life is not random. And often, you know, you often talk to people around and they say, how are you feeling? Gosh, life is so overwhelming. It's so hectic. It's never been this bad. How can I bring children to this world? And I'm like, what do you know about history? You think this is bad? Compared to what? Compared to maybe the last 20, 30 years that we got a little break from history? This is hard, but that's life. And like, which part of life? You know, I always joke that you go to matric farewells and you go to graduations and everyone's like, the world is your oyster and you can conquer the world and everyone's waiting for your message and the world's a beautiful place. And it's like, stop lying to people. Life is messy. Paradise is a beautiful place. Life is a place to grow. Life is a place of challenge. And yes, hopefully in this world, we have a few moments of pleasure and we have a few moments of nachas and we have a few moments that we can, you know, walk on the ground and take the sunshine and feel the grass between our toes. But most of life is hard. That's the point of life.
You know, I must tell you something that my grandfather, who was not Jewish, and actually he only believed in going into a church if there was a funeral or a wedding. So, but he had an amazing philosophy in life, and quite a few of us were at boarding school. And you know that every week he wrote to each of us. He lived on the coast in Durban, but every week he would write to us, and he would always end his letter, your loving grandfather, and your dear grandmother sends love. I don't know if she could write. My cousin and I were talking about it the other day because she never wrote to us, but he did. And one of the things that he actually said to us was that he said, he got us all together. We used to all get together in December, but my mom had a big family. And he once gathered all the grandchildren and he said, I need to tell you something. Life is a hard taskmaster. And we said, what is a task, Opa? And he said, a task is something God expects you to do. So we asked if we could choose our tasks. You know, could we kind of choose what we wanted out of the tasks that we were given? And he said, definitely not. It's something that you will be expected to do. And you can't ever refuse God's request. And that is something that I think has stuck with all of us. As you know, as we have aged and brought up our own children. And just on a different note, I'm being told to go to an advert, but just on a personal note, my eldest son, who you know very well, Norman, is named after my grandfather, whose name was Norman Webster. Oh. And he passed away when I was pregnant with Norman. Thank you, Craig. Even in times of darkness, we can choose to shine our light and uplift one another. So join the community to commemorate Yom HaZikaron tonight on Monday, the 20th of April. It'll be a moving ceremony where we carry the light for Israel's fallen and for victims of terror. The gates open at 6 and proceedings begin at 6:30 sharp. Then on Tuesday, the 21st of April, tomorrow, bring along the whole family and be the light as we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut together. There'll be rides, food stalls, school performances, and top local entertainers. Gates open at 4 p.m. and proceedings start at 6. For more information, go to sazf.org/78. Don't miss Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, two incredible community events brought to you by the South African Zionist Federation, your connection to Israel in South Africa.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM. If you would like to WhatsApp us, please do so on 061-895-1019. My guest today is Rabbi Levi Upton, and we're talking about a topic in their name, which we had dedicated to Rabbi Upton's uncle. And we've been talking about Rabbi Upton's family, his maternal grandfather and grandmother in Russia, and the responsibility to remember, and not only just to remember, but to recognize that what will we do with this memory? Are we just going to bury the memory, or are we going to look at the life that was lost, the lives lost? What are we going to do about it? As I read you that advert now about Yom HaZikaron tonight and Yom HaAtzmaut tomorrow. And, you know, we came last week through Yom HaShoah, which was the Holocaust Remembrance Day. So this particular month, tell me a bit about this month, Iyar, Rabbi. What are our responsibilities here?
So this is an interesting month because it's a month where every day we have a mitzvah. It's called counting the Omer. It's a commandment to count the Omer. And during the Omer, many South Africans are aware, it's a time that we have some level of mourning. It's not the most intense mourning, but some level of mourning. And we commemorate a time about 2,000 years ago when a large group of people, 24,000 students of a great sage, Rabbi Akiva, died in a very short period of time. Now, even though the Jewish people have lost many, many people and many more than 24,000, even during that time of history, it was after the destruction of the temple and many other calamities, nevertheless, the rabbis felt that a special time has to be dedicated to this because the reason they all died, it was a punishment from heaven for disrespecting one another. And this time is designated as a time to focus on respect. You know, we always talk about loving one another. I think the word love is so abused and it actually means anything you want it to be. In other words, you know, you could love a celebrity who will never love you back. You could love politicians who don't even know your name. You could love, you know, somebody in high school who actually finds you distasteful and disgusting. The point is, love doesn't say anything. And you could also treat people you love very terribly. Mm-hmm. It's a much more important word. And Judaism sees that word as kavod, respect. Mm-hmm. Respect means boundaries. Respect means I will never treat you a certain way, right? You cannot hurt somebody you respect, but you could hurt someone you love.
So true.
And this idea of respecting one another, we always focus on the idea, you know, as Jews, we all have to learn to love each other. I don't love everybody. That's impossible. Not everyone's my type. You know, love is a big word, at least in the purest sense of the word. You have to enjoy their company. You have to, you know, I mean, not all of us love our own, you know, in-laws and siblings, and you know, it's impossible to love everybody. We all have different.
Hard enough loving ourselves.
100%.
We need to respect ourselves.
Right, but respect is possible. In other words, I can respect people I don't like. I can respect people I don't love, but I can still treat them with dignity. I can realize they're maybe not my type, Maybe I wouldn't marry them. Maybe they're not exactly the people I want to go out for coffee with, but they are God's creations. They are human beings created in God's image who are worthy of respect and dignity, and they have people who love them, and they have their own journey, and they have their own thing. And maybe even though they're not my type, when I come to heaven after 120, I might discover that they were even better than me, and that's okay. So therefore, a person who learns the lesson of this time walks this earth with deep respect, and they realize, I don't know people's journey. We were talking earlier about, my grandparents and their journey. If you met my uncle, if you met my grandparents, you would know nothing about them. You would just see them as, some religious fanatic with a black hat. You know nothing about what brought them to the moment. We know so little about each other. And when we in the context of Israel and all the days that are coming up, it's like one of the big challenges Israel has is not necessarily the enemies without, but the struggle to get along, right? If Jewish people are going to survive, and please God they do, in our homeland for many years to come, the biggest challenge will not be our enemies outside, even though they have to be dealt with. It's, can we figure out to get along? Can we figure out a way to disagree and still respect, to see the value in somebody?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's so often said that before October the 7th, 2023, in Israel, there was such divisions between all the different groups, and there was such anger, and and what the amazing thing was that we talk often about the October the 8th Jew, but perhaps what came in then, I don't know, maybe you would think differently, but do you think perhaps respect came in after that horror? Respect that people were actually surviving?
I wouldn't frame it the same way, because respect doesn't happen automatically. I would say that the division was put away because we all had to fight together. Mm-hmm. But we still didn't learn respect. And therefore, once the intensity of the battle subsided and election season's coming back, right? Elections are in 6 months in Israel. It's all coming back. In other words, it's the same division, right-wing versus left-wing, Haredi versus non-Haredi, the whole shebang, everyone seeing each other. Because respect is a conscious choice. Respect means I realize that in God's world, we will never agree. God did not create a world of homogenous thinking. Right? The Talmud says, just like we don't have the same facial features, so too we don't have the same opinions. We were born differently. Some of us are born and we see the world in a more liberal way. Some of us see it in a more conservative way. Some of us come from a religious perspective and we see the world through that perspective. Some see it from an atheistic perspective. Some, want to impose their worldview on everybody else. Other people want to be left alone. We're just different. Mm-hmm. And communism, which I was talking about earlier in the topic, communism's big idea that they brought to the world, at least they thought to bring to the world, is we can get everybody to think alike. But you know the way to do that? Stalin had to kill 25 million people, send tens of millions of people to the gulags, and basically shoot you in the head if you don't bow down to his photo. That's the only way you can create homogenous thinking. That's what Kim Jong-un is doing in North Korea. Okay? That's not life.
Mm. Absolutely.
We will disagree, and that's okay. Why the inability to look at somebody else and see their humanity and still respect them, even though they see the world so different to you? It's okay.
And I think we see this so often in families where brothers are turning on brothers and not, or sisters, I'm saying brothers, but sisters on sisters. And you ask, what is the problem? And you're told, and it's something that can easily be, well, I say easily, but if I'm looking at it from the outside, I think surely this can be worked through. But when you're in it, they say, definitely not. We're never going to speak again. We're going to ad break quickly.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. My guest today that I've really enjoyed is Rabbi Levi Atzon from the Lingsfield community, but from many, he certainly has an influence on many, many other communities too. We're going to go to a very short YouTube by Elie Wiesel, Every Person Has a Name. Thank you, Craig.
My father was actually an owner of a grocery store, but he was most of the time busy with communal activities. I felt not angry, I could never be angry with my father. I felt deprived. He was so busy with other people's destinies that I felt I also deserved his attention. And he was arrested. He spent many weeks. I know he was tortured. And, you know, my father and I, therefore, we became very, very close, mainly inside the camps.
Why didn't you fill in a pigeon's testimony until now?
Because I have written about it myself. And I felt, why should I condense what I have to say in a few books in one page? And therefore I felt it wasn't needed. But now I was convinced, persuaded by Avner Shalev that I have to add to my work that page as well. And these pages are very important because they are meaningful. What do we believe in? We believe in names. Therefore, we have the same names, actually. Usually, we have my grandfather's name, and my son has my father's name. So a few names, actually. And every name has a story. And all these stories become history. And this is what you are doing. Today, November 22nd, 2004, will be a special day. And an appeal is being issued to all those who had any connection, family connection, personal connection, with that tragedy, should fill out these pages. It is important because it creates a link not only with the dead but also with the living. And I urge anyone who has access to a computer, and I don't know how to use it, but I know that many people, most people, have that knowledge to use that link. And so if I would like to know, for instance, what happened to my distant cousin, I would know where to turn. And I know there are cousins that know more than I about their lives. So it would create a link within the Jewish people, between families, between cities, between communities. It can only bring a heightened awareness and a deepened sense of remembrance.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Rabbi Levi Atzon, and our time is going quickly, and I know we're going to be told to wrap up soon. Rabbi, there is a collective memory, which I think we have a responsibility for as well, apart from our personal memories of our families. Well, how would you like to define, actually, almost like, why does it matter? Why does it matter that we do remember?
Because if we don't learn the lessons of the past, then we're destined to repeat it, right? I'm not the first person to say it. And it's not so much for them. In other words, often memory, we focus on that they deserve to be remembered. But the truth is, God remembers them. And they're in a place of truth. The most important part of memory is not to honor those who are gone, but to for us to learn lessons of them. As King Solomon writes, V'achai yitena libo, the living have to take to heart. The living have to learn lessons. So that's really what we're living in. We have to read history. We have to know our family stories. We have to know the collective story of our nation and our people. But it's all about me becoming a better version of myself. All they want, all the people who have sacrificed so much, they sit in heaven, I believe, and they look down at us, and all they're asking is, show up, fight on, be a better version, learn our lessons, because the life is for the living, and that's what we're here to do.
Beautiful way to wrap up. And as you said earlier, it's not about loving them, it's about respecting one another. And if we can only respect one another, perhaps the world will look very different. But it's not something that you and I can tell the world, but we can each and every one of us has a responsibility to respect one another, and also to prevent the dehumanization that is happening in the world at the moment, that of people being put down as collectives. So let's pray for peace. And as we go into Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, let us celebrate life with respect and honor one another and our histories. Thank you so much, Rabbi, for sharing this time with me.